This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Justin Amash is seeking his fifth term in the U.S. House. The Republican represents Michigan's 3rd District. That includes all of Calhoun, Barry, and Ionia counties, as well as most of Kent and part of Montcalm County. We are speaking at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in Battle Creek. Justin Amash, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Gordon.
So what would you like to do if you get another 2 years in the House?
I'd like to keep defending people's rights, serve as a continuing check on the executive branch, and try to improve the process in the House so that more people can be involved in amending legislation, in deliberating legislation, so we can better represent the people. And I think whether you have Republican leadership or Democratic leadership, there's a lot of improvement we can make there.
Well, explain a little bit. What's wrong with the process right now? Where does it go wrong?
It's totally closed right now. We have the most closed process in the history of Congress, in this current Congress. Not a single time during this whole Congress, the 115th Congress, have we been permitted to go to the House floor to offer an amendment. Every amendment has to be pre-approved by the Speaker of the House, brought to the Rules Committee, where you'll have some, essentially a show hearing, and then at the end of that hearing on your amendment, they'll tell you whether you can have it or you can't. It has nothing to do with anything you said there. What it has to do with is whether the amendment has a chance of passing and whether it will actually make substantive changes to the legislation. If they think that it will substantively change the legislation and has a chance of passing, the Speaker is going to shut it down and tell you you can't have it. And that's true whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. So this is the first Congress in the history of Congress where zero amendments have been allowed directly on the House floor. All of the amendments have to be pre-approved.
So this term of Congress, this particular term, you think has been more closed than the previous terms when you were
yes.
a member? I mean, this is firsthand experience for you.
Yeah, this is worse than previous terms. And, you know, we weren't happy with Speaker Boehner. We certainly had our concerns with Speaker Boehner. But compared to this, he was fairly open. And Speaker Boehner ran one of the most closed houses in the history of Congress himself. And that was fairly open compared to this. So I think that Speaker Ryan has not done a good job as Speaker. I've said that many times. I think it was a mistake to support him. And I'm not convinced that the Democrats, if they're in charge, will offer a better alternative. They'll probably continue this new tradition of closing down the entire House, which has gradually gotten worse over the past 30 or 40 years. But we have to do a lot better.
If the Republicans were to keep the majority in the House, and assuming you're reelected, is there someone that you would support for Speaker?
I haven't decided yet what I'm going to do. Jim Jordan, my friend, is running for Speaker of the House. I think if we have the majority and it's Jim Jordan versus Kevin McCarthy, for me, that's not a difficult question. I'll support Jim Jordan because he's far more likely to open up the process than Kevin McCarthy, who's currently serving in leadership and we haven't seen anything out of it.
Let's talk a little bit about Saudi Arabia. You've introduced a bill related to the investigation into the murder of Khashoggi. Basically, this would halt arms sales to Saudi Arabia, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And until what point?
Well, the latest bill that we introduced would halt it permanently. So we're not asking for the Secretary of State to certify anything. I think most of us have enough evidence at this point that we shouldn't be sending arms to Saudi Arabia, selling them arms. We shouldn't be refueling their planes as they engage in this war in Yemen. And so I'd be for halting the arms sales regardless of the outcome here in this case, because I think this is just one more example of what's wrong with the Saudi regime. We're not going to base all our decisions just on this incident. I think this is just the latest one and maybe not even the most egregious one when you consider the war that's been going on for a long time and their overall human rights record.
Does the U.S. need to do anything else related to Saudi Arabia beyond that?
No, I'm not calling for sanctions or anything like that. There are countries around the world that do all sorts of terrible things, and I don't think we can sanction every country I don't think we should take military action in other countries where it doesn't affect our interests, or where there's not some kind of genocide going on or something like that. So in this case, I would say, hey, we're just not going to sell you weapons, and we're not going to help you with your war. Beyond that, if they still want to engage with us in some other ways, there are other ways where we will still engage with them.
Are there times the U.S. has to be realistic about who is in charge of a country, what the strategic interests are, that there may not be great options in a particular region?
Yeah, you always have to consider the overall strategy, because the world is full of all sorts of unsavory regimes and other things. But and you have to consider the environment there in the Middle East, and Iran's influence and Saudi Arabia's influence and the other countries in between. And the issue is, at the end of the day, there is some line you have to draw. And I believe Saudi Arabia's human rights record, their disregard for civilians in their war, their treatment of women, all sorts of other factors lend me to believe that we shouldn't be selling them weapons, that it's not the right thing for the U.S. to do. And is there like a perfect dividing point between the countries we should sell weapons to and should not? I think a lot of times it has to be some judgment call. You're going to have to base it on a lot of factors. And in this case, I think Saudi Arabia just is beyond the pale in what they're doing.
The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a report recently warning of some dire consequences in the near future if action is not taken. Should the U.S. be moving quicker to address issues of climate change?
I think we should engage with the world. I don't think it's a good idea for the U.S. to totally disengage from the world. Climate change, I think, is a real thing, and that humans contribute to it. The question after that is, how do we address it? And I certainly understand the reservations of many people when China doesn't have to take the same steps we do, for example, to address climate change, when you have these world pacts that President Trump has withdrawn us from. At the same time, we should stay engaged with the rest of the world. We should talk to them about solutions, and we should talk about how we might contribute to solutions. And for me, one of the most important things you can do to ensure that our climate continues to get, that we're not affecting the climate in the same way, we're not harming our environment in the same way, is to improve the economic standards here and around the world. And that means making sure we're engaging in trade, that we are spreading the virtues of the free market system, which has helped this country become prosperous relative to the rest of the world. I think those kind of things will help us keep our environment clean, because when you have strong economies, you then have populations that are much more willing to devote some of their resources to clean environments. If you have very weak economies, where people are doing very poorly, where people are suffering, those people don't have a lot of time to think about whether they're polluting the environment. They're just trying to get by day to day. And that's the case with so many people around the world today.
So you mentioned trade. Are the policies that President Trump has been pursuing what you would have thought a Republican president would try to do if we had been having this conversation 2 or 3 years ago?
No, certainly not. And I think he's doing the wrong thing with respect to tariffs and with respect to the trade war. He's talked about having this new agreement with Mexico and Canada, but it's largely, from all appearances at least, NAFTA 2.0, basically a revision of NAFTA. So on the one hand, he is creating barriers to trade, adding tariffs. On the other hand, he's proposing solutions that look like things that have already been done. So it seems like a big mess. And tariffs are never the way to go. They harm Americans more than they harm anyone else. When you put tariffs on goods coming in or services coming in, you're taxing Americans. You're making things more expensive for us. you know, take the steel tariffs. It may help a few steel companies in the United States, but it certainly hurts a lot of businesses in our country. I hear from businesses in our community, in our district, who tell me that these are American manufacturers. They're manufacturing here with American employees. And they're telling me, well, now the cost of goods is so high that, you know, they're going to have to maybe lay people off. Their taxes are going to be incredible because tariffs are taxes. So these are huge problems, and a lot of those costs get passed on to consumers.
Is there a point where you could argue that a trade agreement is out of balance and that United States companies and workers don't have a fair shot, and therefore there should be some sort of action on the part of the United States to try and level the playing field?
So I think that we should negotiate with other countries. I certainly think NAFTA is outdated, that we can make big improvements to it. And there are, in the proposal that I've seen, at least the outlines of it, there are improvements in some aspects. But there are also new aspects of the agreement that look like they're going to make things worse for Americans. So, we should engage. We should try to improve trade agreements that exist. I think the goal of any trade agreement is to reduce barriers across the board. You want barriers to our goods and services going to other countries also reduced. At the same time, you don't want to add new barriers to people coming over here. I don't think that's a good strategy to persuade other countries to drop their barriers, to add new barriers. I think that just escalates things. And frankly, my concern is that some of these other countries, particularly ones that don't have the same political system we have, where the people aren't free, they might be willing to take a tougher stance, harm their own people in the short run, just to hold out against the United States until we break politically.
Healthcare is an issue once again. It has been for the last several election cycles. Give me sort of the ideal healthcare system the United States would have if it were just up to Justin Amash.
So I think the ideal healthcare system would be largely market-based, and you'd handle healthcare issues at the state and local and private level, not at the federal level. Now, having gone through all the debates over the past several years, I know that the system that most people will find desirable is one that has a very large market-based component, but also a backstop, a safety net for people who are low income, who have disabilities, who have pre-existing conditions. I think the mistake we've made, though, is in trying to alter the entire system to make it less market-oriented, which raises costs on everyone. A better approach would be to keep the market-oriented system, and then for people who have particular needs, who are struggling, you would provide benefits directly from the government. And this is something that I think Republicans and Democrats believe, a system where you get benefits, rather than altering the entire insurance system, adding a whole bunch of regulations to the marketplace. It will be much more cost effective and much better for people just to receive direct benefits from the government, preferably at the state level, rather than altering the entire system. I think you'd lower costs, and the cost of providing the benefits would also go down.
Does a market-based system, though, with some sort of a, as you said, a backstop, or, you know, if you want to use another term, I guess, safety net,
yes,
for lower-income people, does that run the risk of still putting people who are doing fairly well into quite a bind if, say, there's a diagnosis that comes along, someone's in a horrible accident, something like that? Could that be driving somebody, from a fairly comfortable, productive lifestyle into financial straits because of their health?
Well, I'm not sure I get the question, but certainly there are things that happen to people in their lives, and you want to have a system that provides a safety net for them. So if someone was doing well and then they were struggling, I think that most Americans want to see some minimal level of care provided, and the care has to be, of course, adequate to their needs and provided to them. But if you have a system that provides everything to everyone, of course, the costs would be astronomical. So what you want to have is a market-based system that will lower the cost of healthcare for everyone and then also provide a safety net so that everyone is getting the adequate care that they need.
The tax cut bill that you voted for and eventually passed into law, is this working for the average American out there, or is it working more for people in the upper reaches of the income ladder?
It was a tax cut for everyone. When you look at the way the code is arranged, it's now more progressive than it was on the individual side. So actually a higher percentage of taxes are being paid by people at the higher end of the income scale. So it was intended to be a tax cut for everyone. It is a tax cut for everyone. There's no doubt that when some people pay a lot of taxes, a very high percentage, that in dollar amounts, they're going to get more dollars back. There's no doubt about that. That's the way just percentages work. But it was designed and intended and works in a way so that everyone gets a tax cut.
Should such a tax cut be passed at a time when the economy is good, if you're not going to also find a way to address spending or find other revenue to not drive up the deficit?
So you have to cut spending. When I look at a piece of legislation, whether it's a spending bill or a tax cut, I look at that bill and decide whether it is a net positive or a net negative for us. And I voted yes on the tax cut because I thought it was a net positive. And I vote no on the spending increases because I think that's a net negative. I think that if you had more people in Congress who took this approach of looking at each bill and doing what's right, you wouldn't have the debt problem you have today. You wouldn't have the deficit problem. They'd be opposing these spending increases. You can have tax cuts for the American people because we pay too high of taxes. You can have tax cuts. But then when the spending bill comes up, you should also vote to cut the spending. You shouldn't vote for a spending increase. And I think that's critically important.
Can you spell out exactly, you know, what areas you would cut? I mean, what are we spending too much money on? What, you know, would you say here are the things we can do without in order to either maintain the current tax rate we have or even cut them further at some point in the future?
Well, I don't think we should have been increasing military spending. We spend way more than the rest of the world on defense and on our military, and a lot of that goes to civilian contractors. So we should be cutting spending there, or at least holding it even. There was no need to have these recent increases. And then we have to look at the largest areas of the budget and find ways to make them work long into the future. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. So all of those areas have to be on the table. If not, you're not going to balance the budget. It's pretty silly for people to say, well, we're going to balance the budget, but we're not going to look at the four largest areas of the budget. You have to look at all of them, and that includes military spending. The problem you have is that Republicans want to increase military spending, and then you have others who want to increase other sorts of spending, social welfare programs and other things, and the agreement they come to is not really a compromise. It's in some sense a conspiracy. They conspire together to increase spending for everything, and that's how we get into this huge hole.
What's your thoughts on the idea of a missile defense system in Battle Creek? Is that a good idea?
I think if the Department of Defense decides that it's a good idea, then it's a good idea. Our decision should be based on defense needs and should not be based on any economic aspects. So I don't think it should be based on does it bring jobs here or there, because every city in the country is going to say we need jobs. So I will always go to bat for my community, and I'll advocate on their behalf. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to advocate on the basis of creating jobs. I will advocate on the basis of this being the best location for our defense purposes. And if the Department of Defense agrees with that, then that's great. But I think there are too many members of Congress who try to base all of their decisions on, does it bring jobs to my district? And I don't think that's a good thing for our country.
When you say if the Defense Department says it's okay, I mean, if you really want to cut military spending, do you have to at some point maybe question the Defense Department a bit and push back?
The problem is not the Department of Defense in terms of military spending. The problem is members of Congress. The Department of Defense comes to us and they ask us not to spend on certain things, and then members of Congress spend on it. You have defense contractors who spread their operations throughout the country, maybe in 60, 70 districts, and then they come to each member of Congress and say, well, you're going to lose these jobs if you don't support our proposal. So it's really not the problem of the Department of Defense. It's the problem of members of Congress.
You have called the redistricting process ugly, and it was a story in Bridge, which had some stories about emails that were shared. Explain exactly what your concerns were at that time.
My concerns with redistricting generally are that it's too partisan, that it's driven by a few interests. Like on the Republican side, the Michigan Chamber had a huge role in deciding the districts. I believe districts should be based on community connections, based on geography, and not based on any sort of political partisan concept. So if you take the district we're in right now, for example, Calhoun County was added to the district. I enjoy representing the people of Calhoun County. But in terms of gerrymandering, did it make the most sense to separate, say, Calhoun from Kalamazoo, which would, I think, be a more natural pairing?
And it was with Jackson County.
It may be a more natural pairing is along this 94 sort of corridor here. And then at the same time, they took Kent County, which, you know, is pretty much a unit in terms of community cohesiveness, and they split that county in an awkward way. I don't think that's the way to redistrict. I don't think that's what the people want. I think people want to have representation that seems to reflect their community, and you shouldn't divide these districts up in ways so that you have one representative here representing people who are very far away from them and not as connected to the community.
Do you think Proposal 2 gets at that?
I think it's an attempt to get at that problem. Does it resolve the whole problem? I don't know. You know, it's a little bit convoluted, but whether it's better than our current system or not, I'd have to believe it's better than our current system. I mean, our current system is terrible. So, you know, I haven't taken a position expressly in favor of any of the proposals or against any of the proposals, but I'll say that I think an independent process is much better than our current approach.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question sort of related to another ballot proposal. Proposal 1 would, of course, legalize recreational marijuana in Michigan, but, of course, marijuana would still be classified as a Schedule 1 drug under federal law. Should that be changed?
Should federal law be changed?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So I've always thought it should be a state decision, not up to the federal government. The federal constitution doesn't have anything to do with drugs or drug laws. So I don't see why the federal government should be intervening in the decisions of things that are naturally the province of the states. So leave it to the states, get the federal government out of it. And I've supported many pieces of legislation to do just that, to give the states the power and take away from the federal government.
What do you think is the federal government's responsibility when it comes to PFASs, which have been found in drinking water in several places, including in Kent County?
I think it's important that the federal government's involved in that because the federal government has contributed to the problem. I mean, we have PFAS located at military bases. We have it located at airports. There are many places of federal jurisdiction where this has been a problem, and we have, of course, EPA oversight of many of those places, and this problem seems to have slipped by everyone. So it's going to have to be a joint effort by the federal government and the states to address these issues and ensure that people at home have the answers. Right now, I think a lot of people are in the dark. They don't know necessarily the impact on their communities. So the federal government has to be more involved, has to work with the state governments to ensure that people feel safe, know the facts, and get safe if they're not.
What would be the sort of comprehensive immigration reform that could get your vote in the House?
You have to start with improving the legal immigration system. The biggest problem we have right now, I think, is that the legal immigration system does not work properly. And when you have a broken legal immigration system, you get more illegal immigration. Many of the people coming in now illegally were here legally, and they overstayed visas because they couldn't find a way to stay legally. So let's make the system easier. Let's bring people here legally. If you think about it, we'd probably have the same percentage of immigrants here. It's just that they'd be legal instead of illegal. And when you have legal immigrants in the country, they are much more likely to assimilate, much more likely to integrate, much more likely to learn English and pay all the taxes and do the other things, much more likely. Why should we have a whole population living underground and trying to hide from the government? We should ensure that they're able to be here legally. And then we can decide as a country what the appropriate rate of immigration is. But certainly, we have been stifling legal immigration for too long. And as a result, we have a large illegal immigration population.
So more legal immigrants would be part of your solution.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier the possibility of the Democrats winning control of the House. We don't know what's going to happen as we sit here and talk, but the entire time you've been in Congress, Republicans have controlled the House. Do you think it would change your job much if the Democrats, you know, have the Speaker and control of the committees, et cetera?
Well, I'm used to working in the minority. I worked in the minority in the State House. And in Congress, I'm very independent. I'm not a party line voter. So I know what it's like to work with leaders who don't necessarily agree with you on everything. I think that if the Democrats were in charge, I would find many ways to work with them, particularly on some of the issues that I've worked on in the past, civil liberties issues, foreign policy issues. Just recently, for example, the legislation we spoke about earlier was introduced by Representative McGovern, and he's a Democrat, and that's the Saudi Arabia legislation.
Right.
So I've worked with Democrats on a number of issues, and I'll continue to work with them. And if Jerry Nadler is the head of the Judiciary Committee, he and I have a good rapport, and we've worked together on many things, and we'll continue to do so.
On the night of the primary, when Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly found out he would not be the Republican nominee for governor, he told his supporters that they had to accept that this is President Trump's Republican Party. Do you think that's right?
Yes. Yeah, I think it is. I think the party has changed in many ways. And, I've stayed the same. I'm going to be independent-minded. I'm a constitutional conservative. And I'm a libertarian, and sometimes I agree with the Republicans, sometimes I agree with the Democrats, and that's the way it's always been, whether President Obama was in charge or President Trump. The party has changed, but, these things have a way of ebbing and flowing, and things could change again in the future. You just don't know. But right now, I think that the strongest base of support is the president's base of support. And I think, it is what it is.
But you were very critical of President Trump before he was elected during the campaign. You said you wouldn't vote for him. You wouldn't vote for either major party candidate for president. And you have at times been pretty critical of him since he took office. So I guess I'm wondering if it is President Trump's Republican Party, is that a net positive? Is it a net negative for someone like you at the end of the day?
Well, these parties are big tent parties. They're not just one philosophy sort of parties. You have a party system that requires you to get more than 50% basically on your side. So you form coalitions. If you had a parliamentary system, you might have a whole bunch of different parties, and you do the same thing. It's just that you form your coalitions after the election, and here we form our coalitions before the election. So, you know, in the Republican Party, you'll have libertarians, you'll have social conservatives, you'll have Trump Republicans, and they work together. And the Democrats have the same thing. You have some people who are very progressive, you have other people who are more conservative, and it's always been that way, and probably will be that way for some time. And at different times, you have different people who are maybe more prominent or dominant in the party. And right now, it's definitely the Trump coalition. And I find ways to work with them where I agree, and where I disagree, I'm not afraid to say so.
Republican Congressman Justin Amash is running for re-election in Michigan's 3rd congressional district. That includes Calhoun, Berry, and Ionia counties, as well as most of Kent and part of Montcalm County. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
We've been speaking at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in Battle Creek. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.